Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to another episode of the Motor Mouth podcast with me, Tim Silvey. Today, I'm joined by Alex Brundle. Alex has just launched Brundle Motorsport, his very own classic race team in partnership with Adrian Flux. He's broadcasting in F1, F2 and Formula 3. He's a very busy, busy boy indeed. We chat all about the Australian Grand Prix, dissecting some of the performances. We talk about his new race team, obviously, and all the exciting plans he's got with that and what the future holds for it. And of course, we touch on his broadcasting work as well. It was a lovely chat with Alex. He's a guy I've known for a few years now, and he's doing some wonderful things in motorsport. I hope you enjoy it. Let's head over there and check in with Alex Brundle. Alex, welcome back to the show. How are you? How are things? What's happening in the world?
I am great, actually. I'm much better than I have any than I really deserve to be, having flown 20 hours back from Australia. But I appear to have weathered it weirdly well. You know, I'll be the first to complain if I was jet lagged to nothingness. But I've actually done well this time, so I'm celebrating that.
Excellent, well done, you. Was it fun in Australia?
Really was. Yeah, love Albert Park, love the people, love the vibe. It's a different thing. I'd never been to Australia before, like even as a tourist. So to go there and have the opportunity to go there for a Formula One weekend was fabulous.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely place to go. Now, let's get straight into it. You have, as everyone knows, an affinity with historic racing cars. Before we come on to the very exciting news that you've released fairly recently, what is it about these historics that you love so much?
I love racing as it was, partially because there was so much more development to go. Right. So you look at these cars and you think they're massively imperfect. You know, they're rubbish by modern standards. They're absolutely rubbish. But that rubbishness comes with a brilliance as well in terms of the drama of them. The scalpel like efficiency of a modern racing car means that there's very little sound coming out of it. In comparison, because all the sound a race car creates is wasted energy, and the modern cars use all that energy to go forwards, and you don't see them go sideways and move around because, of course, that's wasted energy, and the modern cars use all that energy to go forwards. So everything we love about racing cars has been kind of slowly edited out to a degree over the years, and old race cars put all of that back in again, as well as leaving a big space in their competence. And I like a big space in their competence because it's a big space that, as the driver, I can fill and go, yeah, I can make it do that when it's not supposed to do that. And I can chalk that up to, you know, Alex can drive. Give myself lots of Alex can drive points around making it do that. So yeah, That's what I love about historic race cars.
And Alex can drive historic race cars, and presumably it's not something that everyone can do. I mean, can you, as for someone who's never driven a historic race car, can they switch from a modern day, very, as you say, sort of, you know, pinpoint accurate modern day race car? Can they easily switch into a historic and not be as quick as your good self, of course, but hold their own?
Or even quicker. It's so weird because it's so personal. You know, you see drivers jump across. Drivers with a mechanical mindset do really well. Drivers who have driven, you know, one chassis engine combination through their full junior single seater career don't do as well. I mean, the big challenge for the youth of today is that they don't do stick shift anymore. I'm probably the last generation of single seater racer to drive an H pattern shift single seater with a dog box in it. So that's a massive advantage. But, you know, to name a, you know, Rob Huff is outstanding, just been re-announced in the British Touring Car Championship. Jake Hill is extremely good. And then drivers like Andre Lotterer are just excellent. They're sort of the older sports car guard. I won't be unkind enough to name some drivers that have really struggled, but there are some drivers, world championship winning drivers, that have broken gearboxes in three corners.
I'm not surprised to hear it. I mean, it must be hugely challenging. I've never had a go, really. The closest I've got, I think, was probably a stick shift at Palmer Sports, and where I've, you know, driven around there in relatively modern cars, but, you know, at least with an old-fashioned, you know, gear lever that you have to throw around, and quite frankly, I was useless. But this has all led to something. So you've got this affinity with these cars, as we've said. That's led to something tremendously exciting. Brundle Motorsport, which must sound amazing. Tell us all about it. How, why, who, when, what caused this to happen?
So me with a lot of cars, mostly. But the aim of it is, obviously, you get some great racing. I mean, incredible racing, you know, 20 GT40s up Eau Rouge happens every September. And there are a group of people who know about this racing, and it is, and it's big, you know, people attending at the racetrack, but it's not really broadcast, you know? And the more I see about motorsport broadcasting, and the more time I spend kind of with the weird helicopter view of racing that being involved in motorsport broadcasting gives you, the more I think, you know, I hear people say, I want these cars to move around. I want them to be loud. I want them to be fast. And the more I make the connection that actually a lot of things that the motorsport audience want are happening right now in historic racing. Someone just needs to shine a light on it. Simultaneously, you know, historic motorsport is at a crossover point, and it's a very interesting crossover point based around the inevitable mortality of human beings. There are now a group of people who are in love with these cars. And the reason they're in love with these cars is because race cars of the 50s, and you know, people kind of my dad's age, you know, race cars of the 50s and mid 60s, they watch them racing as they grew up and they remember them, right? So they've kept these race cars running because they really wanted to drive them when they were 15. And now they've got the opportunity to drive them by hook or by crook, and they race them. But there will come a time where those people are unable to race those cars anymore. And they are not, you know, either armed to do so or old or passed on or whatever. So historic racing needs, you know, sort of the other side of the deal, if you like, is that historic racing needs a new generation to be resold these racing cars on the basis that they're fast and loud and awesome as they are. Movies like Le Mans 66 do such a brilliant job of that, but we need to keep on doing it. Otherwise, they'll all get thrown in a shed and just rot themselves to bits, which would be tragic considering the fact that the audience, when they see this stuff, and I've got the numbers to prove it, love this stuff.
Yeah. You know? So how do we sort that out? Because I mean, when I was growing up, I watched Formula One generally, obviously because of the teams, and Formula One's probably a bit of an exception here. You get real hardcore team fans as much as you do the driver. But for me, it's a lot about the driver, and I have my favorite drivers. I have to admit, I'm not au fait with historic racing yet. This will probably, you know, start tuning me into it a little bit. But is it about the people who are driving those historic cars and getting younger people behind the wheel? Is that one way we're going to try and, you know, ramp it up a little bit?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, yeah, firstly, getting younger people behind the wheel. Secondly, you know, there is an amazing, amazing innovation called the internet, and it's where a new generation do their viewing, they do their televisioning, they do their buying, they do their selling. So, you know, I am kind of in a sweet spot age where I can drive and I'm interested in these cars, but also like sort of the first era of racing driver really to sort of discover the power of being able to reach everyone in the world instantly, you know? And I honestly think that if the internet had existed in 1965, motorsport would have probably been the biggest sport in the world. In fact, if the internet had existed in 1965, motorsport would probably be banned by now because people could see how extreme and how unbelievable and how vicious those cars are. So, but I think by sort of communicating that, using the tools that we have today to sell the cars that we had yesterday, you can get a very long way.
So as Jamie Chadwick is on a sort of one woman crusade to get women's racing more into the limelight and more bums on seats, is this Alex Brundle on a one man crusade to bring historic racing into the front of everyone's minds?
Yeah, I think it's fair to call it a crusade. I think it's a valid plight, you know, and also kind of looking at things ecologically as much as anything. I mean, it's not the most ecological pursuit, but trying to push forward the forum of things like sustainable fuels as an option moving into the future, you know, kind of say things like, yes, I understand that. You know, we can move forward in terms of our fueling technologies and our energy technologies, but even still, the most ecological car available in the marketplace today is the car that already exists that you don't have to build. Yeah, does that mean you have to go and buy a 1961 Corvette C1? No, it doesn't, but it's still something worth communicating. I love race cars. This encapsulates everything I love about race cars. And I think that it's worth communicating to a new generation to see if they feel the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And Brundle Motorsport as an entity supported by Adrian Flux.
Yes.
So what's the setup there? So are you now effectively a team boss and driver and will have other drivers racing for you?
Correct. So over the years in the World Endurance Championship, I've driven for multiple teams where, I mean, think of it as sort of Tolman Enstone, Benetton Enstone, Alpine Enstone. I'm doing a kind of a similar thing. So we organize, we promote, but there are a group of people who know how to run and operate these cars. And it would be incredibly silly of me to go, you know what, all of you, I can do a better job than you. And so I'm just going to go out on my own, set up a workshop. Alex Brundle and a spanner tries to run an E-type Jag, not very smart. So we're collaborating in the industry to try to use the kind of expertise of those people to run these cars. And then I'm doing what I'm good at, which is communicating the racing. We're inviting a load of different guests along that go across the eras of motorsport. So some drivers that the kind of traditionalist racing fans will be across. For example, we've got David Brabham driving for us at the Goodwood members meeting. Some drivers that will be entirely familiar to the new generation, YouTubers, you know, Instagram stars, and people like that, to try to get the broadest possible appeal for the championship, for the team that we can. And we're going to race four cars over the year, over some of the biggest racing festivals across, you know, the UK and Europe, with guest drivers behind the wheel. I'm properly throwing them at the cars and saying, have a go in that. See how you get on. We're insuring it. Please try not to crash it. But, you know, let's see. I'm sure some of them are going to be outstandingly wildly brilliant. I'm sure some of them are going to be struggle a little bit more, but that's going to be the joy and the fun of it.
Yeah, I'm already shitting myself slightly at the prospect of someone crashing one of those very lovely cars. Talking of which, can you pinpoint a favorite? What's your favorite classic car to take on track?
So I drove in the middle of last year, and anybody who's been following our progress will be able to say which car I'm going to say immediately. But I drove a 512M Ferrari, which is the, anybody likes the original Le Mans movie by Steve McQueen, you've obviously got the 917 Porsche. The 512M Ferrari is the other one. Yeah, it's the Ferrari that they're racing against. It's a V12, often mistaken for a flat 12, but it's a V12, and it, you know, you push the throttle down and it sounds like the earth is rotating backwards. The car is not going forward. It is just full on, you know, full on bit of machinery.
Okay. Second part to that question. Where would you take it? Favorite track?
So I've been begging and pleading to take it to the Le Mans Classic, because I just want to hear it. I just want to hear it in fifth gear pulling down the Multan. But I mean, I've raced at the Le Mans Classic, and I don't think I've ever been so frightened in my life, frankly.
Really?
It was just, the thing is that this kind of racing, people kind of look at it and go, it's just, you know, a load of sort of kind of tweedy blazer brigade hanging out with their cars. Man, it is the most extreme stuff.
Yeah, like I can imagine. But this is the challenge, isn't it? That's the perception that people like you have got to change, and let's hope it does it. Let's turn our attention to Formula One. You're a busy boy. You're not only doing all the Brundle Motorsport bits and pieces and the historics, but you're commentating and broadcasting across F3, F2 and Formula One. Are you loving it?
I am loving it. It's incredibly busy from the start of the weekend. I mean, I called 72 drivers, over the line in Melbourne, because you know you've got Formula 3, which is 30, then Formula 2, then F1. So it's wildly, wildly busy. But, you know, I get a view of the whole picture of the whole F1 weekend. There's not a huge amount of downtime. I need to be really careful that to the content I put out there, as you'll know really well, there's always, it's the content iceberg, isn't it? What goes out versus what you have to know to be able to say absolutely what goes out in the moment. So you've got to manage your time really well. But it's a joy to be able to talk to so many people as well over the weekend across both networks that I talk to. So that's great.
And what do you think is the current health of Formula One? There's been loads of controversy lately. We all know about it. We don't need to cover that stuff off in any detail. But broadly speaking, from a sporting perspective, how do you look at the health of the sport?
I mean, I'm coming off one of the most attended F1 Grand Prix of all time.
Absolutely.
That speaks for itself in a way. Viewer figures are good. The health of the sport is good. And I think, you know, you've got a fan base now who interest is meeting depth of knowledge in a way which is much more than I think over previous years. I think when the Drive to Survive boom in terms of Formula One interest happened, everybody kind of went, yep, amazing. But those fans, I wonder if they're going to turn into enthusiasts beyond being fans. And I think the conversion rate from sort of casual fan to enthusiast is certainly greater than I expected. And the depth of knowledge and interest of those fans and how much they demand from the broadcast and from the sport is huge as well. We've got to work really hard as broadcasters and as a sport to service that fan base and make sure we keep F1 interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely changing. I mean, as you probably know, I manage a roster of content creators in Formula One now, and I think every single one on our roster, and I think we've got 35 or 36 of them now, every single one pretty much came from Netflix, Drive to Survive. But it's funny talking to them. Like you say, they know their stuff now. They're not new fans anymore. They're people that really know what they're talking about. So the landscape is changing, but good to hear it's in good health. Now, what can we take from Australia? There were signs that things could get a bit more exciting throughout the rest of the year. It wasn't necessarily a clean weekend for Red Bull by any means. Are we starting to see some chinks in the armor there, do you think?
I think so. I mean, it's an interesting one. The qualifying data showed that the Ferrari is really good in the medium speed. So it's going to be, you know, the Red Bull's still efficient at top line speed. You can see that everywhere they drive. There's a few kilometers per hour in the very highest speed sections. But what the Ferrari does have is just that kind of medium speed and also compliance. So bumpy circuits, circuits with a sequences of medium speed corners. I think we're going to see the Ferrari challenge definitely on qualifying day. Sainz was, you know, on in terms of lap speed, faster than Verstappen in qualifying. He made a mistake in turns 9 and 10, you know, kind of understandably, considering he'd missed the last race and had his appendix out and was racing with significant pain. Man, that was impressive. But yeah, he you know, as a fact, there was an error in turn 9 and 10. So they should have started on pole. I think Leclerc was unfortunate, losing the final lap as well. So, you know, you could easily have had all Ferrari front row there, which would have been a great race. Perez spoke to me after qualifying and talked a lot about tyre degradation for the Red Bull on the softer compounds of tyre, which Pirelli seemed to be trending towards more and more. So I think all of those factors together give us, yeah, a Ferrari versus Red Bull battle with a sort of McLaren versus an on-form Mercedes or an on-form Aston Martin battle behind that.
Now, I'm really keen to get your take on this. So I've been having some debates online with various fans about the Hamilton departure to Ferrari and the motivations behind it. Not necessarily, well, sporting, I suppose. He's going for driving reasons, obviously, but there's a lot of money involved. He's on a big salary already, something like $50 million a year. He's going over there to something what's rumored to be $80 million plus $20 million for his foundation. What do you think is his motivation for going? Is it purely sporting and seeing a car that's developing and an eighth world championship? Is it money driven? Is it a combination of all the above? Is it about his foundation? How do you see it?
I mean, I think humans are more, you know, especially sports people who've been in sport a long time, are more complex than a sort of a binary, it's because of that, it's because of this. I mean, you know, offer to double anyone's money, you know, whether you're making 200 quid a day and are offered 400 quid, or you're making 50 million and are offered 100, doesn't really matter, does it? Offer to double someone's money, it's an incentive. Clearly, Mercedes are not performing. There's an element of frustration there. I think Melbourne was probably one of the most frustrating weekends for Mercedes because they didn't even show the early promise in the weekend that they have throughout the rest of the season. It's a bit of all of the above, I think. You know, to say that it's only about the sporting side of things, I mean, I think human nature is different to that, right? We all want to do as well as we can out of sport, you know, out of life, out of, you know, so to drive in red is a dream of all race car drivers as well. That's clearly a factor. The money's clearly a factor. And to have a car which is capable of performing, which it clearly is a factor. I mean, I think Lewis and management are quite good at the chess game. You know, if you look at his jump from McLaren to Mercedes, that was timely.
Absolutely. And I suppose the interesting part of it as well is the whole Carlos Sainz piece. Because, you know, as you say, as you've hinted at there, he did an absolutely astonishing job in Australia, particularly after his operation. You know, something like 12 or 13 days before, he was literally lying there being cut open. So where does this leave him? And do you think there'll be occasions where Ferrari think, oh, crap, I wish we had Carlos back in the car at this track?
Yeah, I mean, it's really impressive from Carlos. I feel sorry for him in the scenario because I don't think he's necessarily underperformed. And yeah, looking into the future, is there an option at Red Bull there? I mean, that would be victory from the jaws of defeat, wouldn't it? If they continue their run of form. You got to remember, though, as well, there's not actually that when you start getting into 2025, there's not actually that long till the next regulation set. So, anything any of them do is a gamble, you know, to the next set of regulations, you know, presuming it's a multi-year contract, to the next set of regulations, yeah, RB could be dominant. It's perhaps as the Red Bull Junior team, if you like, perhaps a bad call, but McLaren could put together an outstanding, you know, car to the next set of regs, and Oscar Piastri could be multiple world champion or Lando Norris. So it's always a gamble, but I think the best option for Sainz will be to Red Bull. That being said, you know, Perez is not underperforming either. You know, in the early phases of this year, it was a bit more of a difficult Grand Prix in Melbourne, but I think he's found consistency. And I don't think there's necessarily great justification to sort of, you know, do anything with Sergio or immediately replace Sergio given his performance in the early phases of the year.
And what about Haas? Because I like Haas. I've always liked Haas. I love an underdog. And I think they've surprised everybody, haven't they? Is this just a case of some top quality defensive driving on occasion? Or is this a car that has actually got some potential?
No, it's got potential. I mean, when you look at the average lap performance, I haven't looked at it yet from Melbourne, but when you look at it from Saudi Arabia, it's because I came back home via Singapore, melted in the brain. When you look back at Saudi Arabia, it was Nico Hülkenberg just behind Lewis Hamilton in terms of average lap speed in the Haas. So,
wow.
I spoke to K-Mag at the end of last year, and he said, the reason we have so much tire degradation is the car doesn't perform in combined load. So it doesn't brake and turn. It doesn't accelerate and turn, which means you end up slipping the tire across the track and you get this kind of horrible tire degradation. It seems that they've managed to fix that now. Hülkenberg's still a one lap machine and very, very good. You know, his lap in Bahrain at the beginning of the year was one of the most exceptional qualifying laps I've ever seen. Super, super crisp. So they seem to have race pace and, you know, new management there, which is very practical management as well. Can't be hurting either.
Now, Danny Rick. So what is going on with him? I mean, he seems as perplexed as anybody with his performance and is standing there watching his teammate go through the qualifying sessions and looking fairly bemused at the times that he's able to get. What is going on? Is this just the natural end of Danny Rick, or do you think there's some fight left in him?
I mean, there's always fight left. You look at Fernando. I mean, you know, you can't age drivers out of Formula One anymore with Fernando still performing. It could be an element of underestimation, I think, of the challenge when he went back. I think he thought, you know, you look across the garage at Sonoda, you look at some of the moments that Yuki's had, and I think Daniel, as a driver, thought, yeah, I'm clear of all of that. Like, I'm gonna waltz in and I'm gonna be the dominant driver here. I think it's also sort of, there was a lot of discussion last year. There's been a lot of movement around the second seat there, you know, drivers in, drivers out. I think Sonoda's had kind of a time where the focus has been off him to actually focus in. And I think he's performing really well, Yuki. You know, he's a great driver by all accounts, and he's not somebody you just waltz in and beat. And I think without spotlight on him, he's been slowly creeping up on it. And actually now has been more of a force across the garage than Ricardo perhaps expected when he took the seat.
Yeah. Now, before we come on to the future, I want to get your take on this. I love putting people on the spot like this. If you were the team boss, and who knows, one day you might be if you carry on with this,
this team to Formula One.
it's got a ring to it.
Yeah.
Who would be your dream F1 driver lineup, and which team boss would you hire? And take, and that's from a sort of recent era, I suppose. Doesn't necessarily have to be drivers on the grid right now, but the recent era.
Team boss, I don't know. I mean, it's, I think I would do it differently. I mean, you know, in terms of team principal, they're such a figurehead. But you know, when you look at the quality, I see it every couple of weekends because McLaren do an excellent strategic briefing in front of Andrea Stella. And the quality of his understanding of everything that's going on and his preparation of the team for the challenge of a race day. You know, you come in hot on race day and you kind of see the preparation that's occurred, and it's it's wildly impressive, like wildly impressive. So I think I would have him at the helm of the organization, you know, in terms of a figurehead. I mean, yeah, cool. Send someone to chat to the media. It's the nuts and bolts that really matter. Two drivers I'd have. I mean, Verstappen is still for me the class of the field. I think probably Verstappen and Norris are the two that I would pick at this stage if I was going to go into a race next year. It would be a kind of tie between Norris and Leclerc. At this stage.
Solid. Yeah, it would be interesting to see someone like Norris against Verstappen and equal machinery, wouldn't it? I'd love to see a bit of that. Now, let's turn our attention to the future. What's the grand plan for you personally? Like, what happens next? You've got a lot going on at the moment. You've got your sort of booming and growing broadcasting career. You've got the race team. Put yourself in 10 or 15 years' time. Where are you going to be?
I've got no idea. Absolutely. Absolutely
really not.
Absolutely none.
There's no grand plan.
No, I mean, I think that I don't think you can really have a grand plan. You know, I still race. I'll be racing the VLN this year, NLS, we're supposed to call it. That's you know, an N24. I guess sort of comms in the front, race team in the back, you know, and work on all of that kind of thing. I think mostly I'm just focused on the moment, in the moment, and making sure that the audience that I speak to are reassured that I'd like to be the person, and I've kind of used this analogy a couple of times, you know, when a nature show comes on television and somebody speaks other than David Attenborough, you kind of sit there and go, okay, I'm prepared to watch a bit of this, but I was kind of really hoping it would be David Attenborough, you know?
And exactly what you mean.
And over time, and I'm sure it will take time, I really hope to be kind of like that to a motorsport audience, where a motorsport audience would hear you and go, I know that Alex has done his preparation, is, you know, understanding what's going on, has done enough racing to talk, you know, cohesively and understandably about this, and has grown as a presenter in a way where I know it's going to be explained to me in a way I understand. And if I could reach that place sort of in that kind of time period where it's like you open up the broadcast, it's the World Endurance, it's Formula One, it's the World Endurance Champion, it's something. And then all of a sudden, and then, you know, I can rock up and the audience go, ah, all right, okay, fine. You know,
yeah, I'm comfortable with this.
That would be lovely. And that would be that was kind of really like, from a media standpoint, the only thing I'm aiming for. Like, it doesn't really, you know, it's not in the shape of like a certain position, or do I want to like grow to become the leader of a certain, but no, I don't. And yeah, with the race team, I have no idea. Like I love spending time around race cars. It's a vehicle for me to continue to do that. And also, you know, if the professional drives dry up, you know, I'm at a lower level, it must be said, than I was, you know, in the car previously. I used to be World Endurance Championship level, didn't work out financially. So now in GT cars, if that eventually dries up completely, it's a vehicle for me to be able to continue driving and being around race cars in a sort of, you know, in a professional way. So those two things, I think, are the future for me.
Do you ever dream? Like, are there moments where you think, oh, this whole, you know, team management thing is pretty cool? Like that. I wonder if I could climb the ladder and, you know, end up being at the very pinnacle of motorsport in Formula One, running a team. I mean, is that beyond the realms of possibility for you, do you think?
I mean, you've got to start somewhere, right? We're running a load of historics now on a program with our sponsors. Like, yeah, but you know, I've been really heartened by the number of people who've come out of the woodwork and gone, will you run this? Will you run that? How about this? How about that? We'd like to sponsor you. We'd like to be involved. And you look at the pace of growth, that's possible. I think, though, in motorsport, I've been around a lot of, how best to phrase it, creative with the truth teams and individuals and people who, you know, I ended up my... were trying to keep their business running and trying to be successful at all costs. And what I will never do in terms of that part of what I do is grow into a situation where I need to do that to keep it successful. Like I will only ever, I have my ropes, you know, and I'll only ever, you know, deal honestly and forthrightly. So I will never grow things beyond the place where I can do so with everybody being appropriately remunerated, treated with respect, and honestly, and everything being honestly expressed. And if that's if that holds me back in that forum, then so be it.
I think it would do the opposite. I mean, I think the one thing I've learned that I'll be entering next year will be my 20th year in Formula One sponsorship and commercial, and it's sponsorship in particular is a completely dog eat dog world. It's savage at times, and as you know, it's extremely challenging to get sponsorship for anything, from Formula One down. But I probably only have 6 people probably in my inner circle that I actually completely and utterly trust. And as you say, there are individuals out there or companies and so on who aren't always doing things in the correct manner. But I've always found that, you know, treating it ethically and correctly over the long term is the way to go and will get you further. You always get found out otherwise, I find. Now we have our final three. I've tweaked these slightly because we had you on the show. I can't remember when it was. It's probably like 18 months ago or something. I'm not sure. Time flies. But we would have asked you a couple of these questions already, so I've tweaked them a little bit. First one is the same, and it'd be interesting to compare what your answer was to this the first time we had you on the show. But what's got you excited at the moment? Could be anything. Doesn't necessarily need to be racing related.
What's got me excited at the moment? Formula One. Hypercar era Le Mans got me excited.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool.
Yeah, Hypercar era Le Mans. I wish I was in it. Honestly, I really do. I would like to have been in it on a different timeline. I am in it, but that's not how it's worked out. But yeah, I'm excited about that. I will be at Le Mans this year in a capacity. And it's an exciting place. Yeah. It's an exciting place to view and witness.
I like it. Now this is a new one ish. We've used this on a couple of people, but it's certainly new for you. What's one lesson your job has taught you that you think everyone should learn at some point in their life?
Oh, this one's super easy. So another broadcaster, God, I can't remember who it was. One of someone I look up to. I can't remember who it was. They said to me, you know, the thing you're feeling really nervous and self-confident about, and not self-confident about, always be aware that there's someone out there doing it badly, extremely confidently.
Yes, I like that.
And it makes you feel instantly better because you know it's true. You know, the thing you feel self-conscious about, always remember there's someone else out there doing it extremely confidently and wrong.
And you only feel self-conscious about it because you care, and if you care, you'll do a good job. So I like that. I'm going to use that myself. Final one for you. What item could you absolutely not live without?
What item could I absolutely not live without? I have a backpack.
Yes.
Like one of those laptop backpacks with like a million pockets.
Nice.
And I exist from the backpack. And I'm embarrassed of the backpack. You know, to the point where you like dress up for a meeting and you're wearing, you know, your shirt and your nice jacket and your like suede boots or whatever.
And on goes and the double strapper.
And I need the backpack. Mm-hmm. Otherwise I forget stuff. So my rubbish, horrendous daggy backpack is the item which I need more than anything.
Does it go over both shoulders?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I'm not cool enough to single strap it either.
No, you can't even sling a single strap over your head and look really down with the kids.
I need it. I go in. I'm going to get people coming up to me, going, "Yeah, there's a backpack." But anyway, the backpack is, and equally, if I changed the backpack. Disaster, man.
Oh, really? Oh, well, that's a shock. I was actually in my head, I was thinking, I'm going to buy Alex a new backpack, but that's not going to happen, is it? This is your backpack for life.
Mate, there's everybody who travels a lot has the combo. Like I say, I have the wallet with the passport sleeve in it.
Yeah.
The backpack and the carry-on. and they're made of pain, hardship, and deep understanding of getting it wrong over many, many years. So there's the magical trifecta.
Love it.
of the wallet, the bag, and the carry-on that are everything of it, that are everything you need.
A little glimpse into Alex Brundle's life, ladies and gentlemen. Alex, it's been great talking to you again. I've missed chatting to you. We did a podcast on the race for a while with Sean Kelly, and it's something that we've talked internally about getting back up and running. So watch this space, folks. But for now, Alex, thank you so much for joining us on the show, and good luck with Brundle Motorsport and all your other broadcasty exploits. I'll see you soon.
Cheers, Tim. See you later.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.